sick and tired living in a town filled with narrow minds and hate. They used to laugh at me, their children called me names. I would run and hide, feeling so ashamed just for being born. I was just a boy punished for a crime that was
Did you hear that? Did you hear that? Filled with narrow minds and hate, punished for a crime that was not mine. Was that remind you of? Was it make you think about? Obviously, this close to not guilty verdict for George Zimmerman in the murder of Trayvon Martin at the tender age of 17, a child, something that young black males rarely get an opportunity to be in this context where there are narrow minds and hate when I was 17. So that's what we want to explore. We want to talk about when you were 17, Brother Lawrence and Brother John. We want to talk about that particular topic. And we're also going to be joined by our good friend Justin Gladden, who's also from Towson. We got all these Towson folks. Justin runs the television station out there at Towson State. Justin, I'm so glad you can join us. Hey. You mic'd?
I think I am.
Okay, that's nice your voice. I think you are too.
Good.
So we're gonna have that conversation about when we were 17. When I drove in here this morning, after my mother struggled when we were living in Perkins Projects, after she struggled and worked hard, like so many of our mothers and fathers do. She was able to buy us a house right down here on Northwood Drive, not far from this university. And when I was on my way here, because I anticipated this conversation, I stopped in front of the house that we grew up in because I was 17 at one point or another when we lived in that house. And I stopped and I imagined that skinny boy coming out of that house. What was he like? Who was he? He was vibrant. He was curious. He was full of possibility. He was insecure. He was afraid. He was a human being. And since then, I hope that I have added some value to the world. What would Trayvon have given us? What are the possibilities? It's not given that he would have been a good person. Mm-hmm. We have to admit that. But it's also not given that he would have been what the system in Sanford turned him into. Mm-hmm. Right? He could have been, and this is a reality, he could have been the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. There's a black man residing in the White House right now who said, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. Mm-hmm. So you all talk to me about who you were when you were 17 and who you are today and what the world would have missed out on if someone would have summarily executed you. That's hard to think about, but we have to think about it in those terms because that's what happened. So I'll start with you, John. Talk to me.
Right. Well, when I was 17, I was a skinny kid. I'm still skinny now. I live in West Baltimore now, but I lived in West Philadelphia then. And I was trying to navigate the world around me, thinking, you know, seeing some of my friends going through challenges, living in a challenged neighborhood, but knowing that I really wanted to achieve some things that were a little bit greater, and knowing that I wanted to go to college. Not having, you know, the money to do so. My family's not a wealthy family by any stretch. Never wanted for anything, but college wasn't anything that we could afford. So I really was working very hard. I was very fortunate and blessed to get scholarships, full scholarships to go to Hampton University and Howard University, and I chose to go to Hampton. I also ran track, and I had a Division II scholarship to run track at a school in Pennsylvania. So for me, it was trying to use whatever tools I had at my disposal to improve my situation, also improve the situation of people, you know, around me, you know. But one thing that was very interesting when I got to Hampton University when I was 17, you know, it was very interesting because now here I was at this historically black college in Virginia. So now I'm a northern kid in the South and being around all these other motivated young black men. And one of the interesting experiences was walking through the mall. Walking through the Coliseum Mall in Hampton. Now, we didn't know anything that there was any kind of challenge, but there were about six of us, you know, walking. Now, we were all honor students. We were here on full scholarships, honors program. And I remember an officer came up to us, a police officer came up to us and said, "You guys have to break it up." And we were like, what's happening here? And he said, "Well, we have a law that more than five people congregated equals a gang. So some of you have to go on this side and some of you have to go on that side." And so for us, it was very mind boggling. So here we are. We're all hyped up and we're on scholarships. And we're here at this great institution and we're down here. And then realizing that there were these, you know, these barriers, these things that we're dealing with, just our physical space, you know, being challenged. But what was also a great blessing for me being at Hampton is that at 17, I was also exposed to one of my first mentors, who was Dr. Zaphon Wilson, who was the first black man that I met with a PhD, who told me at 17, "You can get a PhD." So here I am now at 34, 17 years later, with a PhD, being a professor and teaching political science, which was the class that I had Zaphon Wilson in, and now giving voice to some of these issues. So talking about issues of race, of class, of economics, of politics. These are all the things that, you know, I wanted to do as a young person, and now having the voice and the ability to do so. Unfortunately for Trayvon, he never got that opportunity. Mm-hmm. See, at 17, we were, you know, I look back and I thought that I was, you know, grown up, but I know how much I really wasn't, how much I hadn't seen
the
world.
There was so much more to you.
There was so much more opportunity, and there's a future and promise, and the idea that all the growth that happens post-17, these 17 yes. years, I've grown and learned so much. And I wish that Trayvon had that same opportunity to grow and learn.
You and I both. I think part of this, part of the underlying narrative is, whose body is this? That the idea that the police would tell you that your presence constitutes a gang, and therefore I have authority to tell you where you can stand or where you cannot stand. Mm-hmm. That harkens back to when we were chattel. And mm-hmm. people had control right. of our bodies. And I could not help but think about that mm-hmm. Under these circumstances where Zimmerman obviously thought that he had control over Trayvon's body and then ultimately took the ultimate control of his body. Yes. He stopped its mobility. So, mm-hmm. Justin, let me come to you, man. Talk to us about when you were 17.
Man, when I was 17, I'm going on a limb here, man, but I was a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. I was vandalized a couple things, broke a few windows, and I was an angry little kid. And I guess I was angry because I couldn't really define myself at that point in time. I wanted to be an engineer, and I was at Polytechnic Institute, mm-hmm. pretty good, pretty decent student, but very distracted by a lot of different things. So, you know, in that course of trying to find myself, you know, I'm like, oh, let me go to the Air Force. And I tried for the Air Force, and I have asthma. They wouldn't let me in. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll apply for a few colleges. Go to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, you know, big, nice, hoity-toity kind of college. Mm-hmm. And they didn't accept me. My SAT scores weren't high enough. But I did get into Hampton. I did get into Morgan State. And I did get into a third college I applied for, and I can't even remember the name of it. But I said, you know, I'm going to give Morgan a shot. And all the while, I'm still wanting to be an engineer. I wanted to be a civil engineer pretty much all my life. And I don't know what happened, but there was a change after that first semester. I said, you know, I want to engage with people. I want to talk to people. I want to interact with people. And I've got this interesting desire to tell stories. So I thought, you know, I'll be a photojournalist. And it was going very well for the past four years through Morgan State. And I met one professor named Eric Dodson, who mm-hmm. sort of mentored me in broadcasting and in television.
Is Eric that old, man?
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. He is that old. He's either that old or he started that young. But I I had a knack for TV. I wanted to learn it because I knew I would need it in the coming media. I mean, this is 10 years ago. This is like 2004 or something. And all my professors here at Morgan were telling me, no, man, you got to, if you're going to be in newspaper, you got to learn still photography, videography, writing, design, all this stuff. Long before this convergence thing happened in 2008. So I thought to myself, hey, okay, I'll learn it when I can. Dotson changed my mind. He changed my entire perspective of television. I really understood what media was about. And I want to hold on to that thought. I want everyone listening to me to remember that. I'm going to talk about that when I get to the end, and I'll keep it short. I'm sorry. But the point is, that's when my transformation happened. That's when I defined myself. That's when I was able to fit into this, like you said, body, this shell of who I am. At 17, I was also an atheist, stone-cold atheist. Mm-hmm. And during my matriculation at Morgan, meeting many people and going through a lot of traumatic experiences, almost drowning at one point. I mean, I really came to understand that there's a lot more to life than what I think and what I know, and I shouldn't be putting that on anyone else. So, I mean, lots of changes happen. Now I'm this media person that you see before you, and I hear people talking about, oh, you know, the media is this, and they're portraying this guy as that, you know, and it's like, you know, you got to remember this media machine that exists, it is a machine, and it is going to cater to what gets the highest ratings. But it's still your job as a human being to find the facts and to develop an opinion of your own, you know. And with that, I like to say that, you know, I do believe that this entire case, this entire trial, this entire incident that's happening is about race. Mm-hmm. And it is about something more than just a prejudice that some guy named Zimmerman had. It's really about, like we really need to be talking about, the laws of the land and the perception people have of not only race, but of our youth. Mm-hmm. When me and Bobby Marvin were producing our documentary, Live Young Blood, we were on the streets of Baltimore City, and we were usually hanging out at night in some suspect areas. We were talking to a father of one of the children that we had interviewed for this documentary, and it's three of us, me, Bobby, and the father sitting on the corner. We got approached maybe two or three times by a young Caucasian brother trying to offer some drugs. I'm like, nah, we're okay, we're okay, we're all right. He's like, yeah, man, if you want some, just come around my house. I live up on Utah Street, you know, 1313, whatever. I forget his address, that's not what it is. But, you know, just come around there, you know, just knock on the door twice, ask for Scott. I'll give you what you need. Like, okay, yeah, no problem. Yeah, we'll check it out. And not but 5 or 10 minutes later, nice big black cruiser pulls up, windows rolled down, and some bald-headed guy comes out looking at us, and this shines this light on. I mean, this light is brighter than the sun in the middle of the night, and I mean, it's bright. We know he's looking at us. He's just staring at us. And me, Bobby, and the father looking at each other like, should we tell him the address of the brother that tried offering him some drugs? Because in all reality, and I'm still calling him a brother. He was a Caucasian man. He was a brother. You know, he lived in Baltimore. He dealt with the struggle just like everybody else. But I'm like, come on. Really? Three people sitting on the corner is a problem, you know. And okay, I understand we're in a suspect neighborhood, but maybe if you got out the car, maybe if you talked to us, we probably would have led you to one of the drug dealers that just offered us something. And that kind of attitude.
And we all have those stories. I remember a few years ago, and I'm going to ask you not to make that bald head comment again. Oh. but I remember a few years ago, I was on this campus going to a meeting, and this is profiling at its worst. Mm. I was on my way, because it wasn't a police officer who profiled me, nor was it a Caucasian that did it. But I was walking on this campus on my way in one of the halls in a corridor on my way to a meeting, and to meet with one of the professors. He and I were working on a project together, and I saw this figure coming down the hall, and the closer she got, the more familiar she became, and closer I got to her, obviously, the more familiar I became. So we got eyeball to eyeball, and she looked at me, and she said, oh, my God, Keith Snipes, I thought you'd be dead by now.
What? Wow.
That was my junior high school principal.
Mm.
That was my junior high school principal, who had, if I had lived down to her expectations, we would not be having this conversation. So the perceptions of young black males, not just from police, not just from Caucasians, but often from within our own community. And we cannot, though I believe there is an awful lot of daylight between the murders that we're seeing in our own community and the circumstances under which Trayvon Martin was executed. I hear people trying to merge the two as if there is absolutely no difference at all in the circumstances where one there is an origin for both, but there is also a line of demarcation that's drawn. There's a separation of those two acts of violence when you look at them from a sociological perspective. You cannot ignore the issue of race when it comes to profiling and so many young black men in this country being violated. I don't know what the circumstances are of that story that we just heard on the news, but you know, someone being beaten by batons and kicked in the head, and then the police say they suffered a seizure. That happens far too often. So, Lawrence, we want to hear from you, man. 17.
Yeah, like Who John. Were you? Like John, I'm also 34, and so 17 years ago, I was 17. It was 1996. That was the year that Tupac and Biggie were shot down. Hip-hop was in a pretty bad place, at least in mainstream hip-hop.
This is a pretty bad place for me to interrupt you, but I need to because I want to. I failed to give the phone number so others can call in and give us their stories. So I want to give that number now. We want to hear from you. The phone number here is 410-319-88. That's 410-319-88. If you have a story that you want to share about when you were 17 and you want the world to know that your humanity has expanded into its fullness and you have become that person you were supposed to be, even if you haven't, the fact that you were still breathing and no one thought that they had the right to take your life, please call us at 410-319-8888. Sorry about that interruption,
no problem.
Lawrence. Go right ahead.
Yeah, and you know, at that time, I was living in League City, Texas, outside of Houston. I was a real nerd at the time. I suppose I'm still a nerd now. And I was on the precipice of going through, like, different phases. After I left high school, went to college at Morehouse in Atlanta, I went through a phase where hip-hop was deeply influencing me. I went through a phase where I had cornrows. You know, I went through a phase where I wanted to take on the pose of being a tough guy, take on the pose of being able to handle my business, as it were, you know, wanting to fit in, you know, with the crowd in some ways before I sort of came into a sense of racial consciousness. At 17, all I pretty much knew about was, like, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and the Underground Railroad. And that was about it, you know. you know, I didn't really understand what I now know as white supremacy, American apartheid, racial terrorism. Those things and concepts were very, you know, they were beyond my horizon at the time. So I was still naive in many ways. You know, like you said, John, thought I knew, you know, a lot of stuff. I thought I had it figured out. But, you know, when I went to college, I found out how much I didn't know, and I began to challenge so many assumptions that I had growing up. And it was only then that I even began the journey of manhood, and I think I'm still on that journey of becoming a man in the fullness, in the full sense of the word. And I suspect, you know, that's where Trayvon was. He was on the beginning of the journey of manhood, and he didn't really have a chance to get going, to really get out the gate. You know, he was a child, and I suspect he was trying to figure out his identity. So in some of the pictures we've seen of him in the media, he was probably going through a phase as well. Give him a couple of years and, you know, he would have been looking like his older brother, you know, in college, and you wouldn't have recognized him.
And he's being judged by photographs,
a slice in time,
folks pulled offline to paint some narrative about this young man. But yet, when his father talks about him, he talks about the Trayvon who liked to cook breakfast for his little cousins, the Trayvon who made sure that whenever a football game came on, he sat down and watched it with his father. You know, the Trayvon who loved his family and whose family loved him. But none of that came out when this case was churned through the court system in Sanford. But yet there are those who will continue to argue that race was not a factor. One of the ways that you can determine whether or not race is a factor is, first of all, look at the person, the subject, and determine whether or not they're black or Latino or anything other than white. And then see if there is a purposeful effort to dehumanize them. If those two factors exist, chances are race is a factor.
Right.
So we're going to go to the phones. We have Robert on the phone, and Robert wants to share a story. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you this morning?
Good, sir. Nice to hear from you. Why don't you tell us about when you were 17?
Well, I must be very frank. This was when I was a little younger than 17, but the fact is that I compare my experience with that to the extent that I could have been another Trayvon Martin because my life was being threatened. I was a young boy in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where I was born at. And at the time, I was only 9, 10 years old. And these three other friends of mine, we used to go out the golf course to carry the golfer's bags. This was in 1947, mind you. And so we was on the way to the golf course this particular Saturday morning, and we was taking the shortcut across this field so we could hurriedly get to the golf course. And so around the bend comes this car, and it pulls up, and it stops, and these four white guys got out. They looked to be around somewhere between 16 and 19 years old, but they were men to us because they were so huge, and we were just, like I said, between 9 and 10 years old. And so, however, they got out the vehicle and they started in our direction. And, of course, we stopped and returned and we looked. And so they kept coming in our direction. So we turned and we started to move fast away from them. So then they started to chase us. So then I ran down this hill and my foot caught on a clinging vine and tripped me. And at the bottom of this hill, there was nothing for me to fall on but a tree stump. A tree had been cut down, and it was this stump here. I hit my face on this tree stump, broke both my jawbones, knocked all my teeth loose, and I was a bloody mess. And so, of course, I started screaming and howling and yelling for help and help. And so this frightened those guys to such an extent, they ran back, got in their car, and took off. Now, I looked at that incident as I got older and felt that, you know, that was a really divine intervention, and that tree stump being there to cause that incident with my mouth. I looked at God placing me in front of that tree stump, or that tree stump in front of me, as divine intervention, because I know that they could have ran me down if not that incident.
Wow,
had happened.
The fact that a tree stump looked inviting. That's amazing. Robert, thank you for sharing your story. We greatly appreciate it. It is just interesting that so many black males, and I'm sure not just black males, I'm sure that there are black women, Latino women, who have had these incidences where their personhood has been violated merely because they're black and brown. I want to look at a couple of things. We only have a few more moments, but Andy Harris, Representative Andy Harris, said on a radio interview that the American, this is how the American justice system, in reference to the Zimmerman case, this is how the American, I'm not quoting him directly, but I am when I say the last part. Mm-hmm. This is how the American justice system works. Get over it. Mm-hmm. But yet, if you juxtapose that to all of the hysteria that took place yesterday over the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. Mm-hmm. Now I get it. Mm-hmm. I understand. Mm-hmm. You don't want the man who killed your loved ones mm-hmm. to be celebrated, accolades. Mm-hmm. Look at this rock and roll star
Stuck
or however he was framed. But yet, what would be the response if George Zimmerman was put on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine? What white America have been as incensed as they were to have the Boston bomber on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. Because after all, we're talking about two murderers. Talk to me about that.
One thing you said is true. You mentioned this is how the American justice system works, and it is how it works. But the piece on get over is very interesting, right? So this is something that's as a mantra, you know, been throughout American history, right? So slavery's over, get over it. Okay, civil rights movement, you know, fight for civil rights. Okay, that's over, get over it. But the reality is the vestiges of all those battles are still with us. But then you juxtapose it to other events, right? So whether it's a Holocaust, never forget. If it's the Alamo, remember the Alamo, but forget about everything else, right? Forget about slavery. Get over that. Get over this decision. Move on, because now it's a new day in America. And that's part of the problem in America, that we become ahistorical, that we don't take note of those lessons from the past, so we don't repeat them. You know, that's a serious problem there. But again, you mentioned also humanity, right? And so if you can rob someone of their humanity, therefore you don't have to discuss them anymore, right? That was just a blip. Now we can move on to the next issue at hand that's more pressing than just this one issue. But we know that it's much more than that.
Sure. There's never enough time for this. I hope to be able to come back and explore this conversation even more. And I think we need to remember Trayvon. Mm-hmm. We can remember the Alamo, but we need to remember Trayvon. We need to remember Emmett Till.
And the four little girls that were bombed in Alabama.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We need to remember that they're human beings, too. So I want to thank my guest. I want to thank Lawrence Brown, a political activist and public health consultant and assistant professor of public health at Morgan State University. I want to thank Justin Gladden, who is creating an entire television station over there at Towson State. Looking forward to doing some work with Justin. Also, I want to thank John Bullock, who is professor of political science at Towson State University. Thank you guys so much for talking about when you were 17.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Mark Steiner Show. I'm Keith Snipes, and enjoyed it. Thanks for listening.